An interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is July 24th, 1993, and this is tape 49, side one. You know, when I was listening to the radio and coming to work, I was thinking about the Midwestern flood, the great Mississippi flood of 1993, and I was wondering whether you as governor had any natural disasters to contend with, aside from the recession.
Yeah. Well, very early on, as we already talked about, it was on St. Helens blowing up in the ash later on, not initially falling in the north part. No, I don't recall. There are always little ones, you know, what I'm talking about. Nothing like this major event. Really vexing in some discussion for quite a long period of time was flooding at Malheur Lake around Burns, and, you know, what to do, and to dig a ditch and drain it and things like that. Some of the farmers are having problems. And we were worried about the rail line in the Union Pacific and the lifeblood of that people in that area economically. It was interesting that after I left office, the next major event and there was the drought in Malheur County. So I said to Bob Smith, I said, Bob, you better make up your mind what you guys are going to do over here. Either get flooded or get a drought. No, nothing like what we, in a major sense like we had here. While I was gone one time, there was an earthquake, and Jerry Thompson had to deal with the potential of a tsunami, and actually issued in their own the fact to have people move back from the beach. Fortunately, it wasn't, but those are things you kind of deal with. In a smaller sense, and one of the reliefs I felt, anything that happens, you feel responsible for. Mm-hmm. Truck turns mm-hmm. over, mm-hmm. and you've got to worry mm-hmm. about it. A little flood here or a little flood there, you got to worry about it. Drought, you got to worry about it. Airplane crash, you got to worry about it. Everything. And once I left office, I said, well, I don't have to worry about those anymore.
Yeah.
Now I can read about them in the newspaper and say, isn't that interesting? Previous to that time, it went beyond interesting. You mm-hmm. had to go do something about it. Mm-hmm. We declared emergencies quite a few times. But we were very cautious about it, and I think I mentioned at the last visit that we wanted to make sure that my declaration of emergency was just one step you had to take in order to get yourself in line for some federal assistance, which is usually, if anything, low-cost loans. You had to make a loan. And too many people thought you declare emergency and all of a sudden everything happens and you don't have to worry about it anymore, and that's not the case. So we did a number of times, and we had forest fires. As a matter of fact, a few heavy-duty ones, and I remember flying over over in the Wallowa area. Oh, I tell you, I sure have to admire the firefighters, because I'm in the air, and I can see it's bad news on the ground. So probably forest fire was a major element to the mm-hmm. over the period of time we had to worry about. Mm-hmm.
Well, going on to what we were talking about the last time, we were talking about bills that you had vetoed, and you had mentioned that you'd vetoed 108 bills, which was more than all your predecessors. And
no, I fell short by four. If I know that, I may have exceeded them.
And more than any other governor except or since Oswald West.
Well, I think actually I vetoed more bills than Oswald West. Matter of fact, I know I did. The only question is how many bills you veto in one session.
Didn't he veto something like 40% of all the bills?
He did more, a third. Well, roughly I'd say a third. Uh-huh. I think it's something like 70, and there was 200 bills that had passed. That was early, of course, 1900. I vetoed 42 in one session, which I thought was great. But then I found out about Oz West in his 70, so as I said the last time, I call myself the modern day record. It was interesting. I, with some degree of pride, was announcing I vetoed 42 bills among my friends up here, and they said, only 42? And, you know, it's also interesting that people get all upset about the number of bills that are introduced. What they really ought to worry about is not how many bills are introduced, but how many bills pass. Mm-hmm. And that's what they ought to look at. Because pass becomes law, introduced doesn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I think we again talked about that. I like the, it's burdensome, it's costly, but I still think having what I call an open legislature is a good idea. No rules committee, all that sort of thing. That gives us an opportunity. We've got a problem we think is a problem, then we have a chance to speak through our legislature.
You exercised your first veto of the session for a measure that would have repealed a state law allowing police to enlist the help of bystanders in quelling a riot. The law most recently was invoked in Linn County when police used bystanders, including members of the media, to remove environmental protesters who were blocking a logging road. Do you recall that?
Yeah.
It seems like there would have been some constitutional problems there, but did that evolve into anything more than a momentary incident?
I need to remember. I in the back of my head, I recall there was some reason that seemed to me it was impeding law enforcement from preventing some things from happening. That is, the bill itself would impede what was going on at the present time. Hmm. I really ought to get some of my own information when we start talking. I can't give you much more than that.
Mm-hmm. There was another veto on a House Bill 2900, which required employers who pay on a piecework basis to pay the same wages to workers under 18 as they do those older. It was aimed at the newspapers.
Yeah, we talked about something like that earlier, and my concern was mm-hmm. allowing young people to get a start in life and getting some business experience.
Right.
And if you keep making it more difficult, all you really do is keep it from young people from being able to start a business career, to somehow get some experience to learn, and in many cases earn money for their education.
You also vetoed key portions of a bill aimed at bringing the Oregon State Lottery Commission's budget under legislative control, stepping into the disputed constitutional waters by doing so.
Well, I understand that the lottery bill went into the Constitution. It was not a law. It wasn't passed law. It was a constitutional measure. And the whole concept of legislative control of a constitutional body, which I didn't, as we talked about before, didn't like to begin with, it was just something I didn't think was appropriate.
The action that you took at the time was a line item veto in which only part of the bill was turned down. And you had cast your first line item veto in 1983 against a bill affecting the public employee retirement benefits. Thomas Clifford, the legislative counsel, said that in 1983 the Speaker of the House and Senate President ignored your line item veto and put the whole bill into Oregon law. But Clifford said the executive branch had ignored the disputed law, leading to a court suit. You said he relied on the Attorney General's opinion that the two lottery initiatives approved by voters in November made it unconstitutional for the legislature to control lottery expenditures.
We talked about that line item veto.
Did we? We've gone over this before?
Well, you recall what I said, that for a long time I thought, my whole career, you could only line item veto budget bills.
Right.
And I said, that's not what the Constitution says. As a matter of fact, according to a Supreme Court decision, that is what it says. Although, if one were to read it, I think any reasonable person would come up with the conclusion I did, that I can veto. as long as it had an emergency clause on it. And so we had not yet been turned down by the courts.
Russell Sadler said that that represented a major shift in power relationships between the legislative and executive branches of government, that view of yours.
Oh, well, Russell kind of over-exaggerates. It was a shift. If it was upheld, that would mean that you'd have control over some substantive law. But I don't know if anything more substantive than budget, because budget reflects programs. And I'm looking at the Constitution and reading, as I say any reasonable person would read, and it says, and any other law that has a emergency clause. It's so clear to me, it's strange how the courts can decide something different. It's absolutely clear if you read the language. But the court said no.
When the voters originally passed it, they passed it for fiscal matters, didn't they? In 1916?
Well, I'm not even sure that's clear.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what, of course, they went back and looked at. And what was the debate at the time? Even if that's the case, you look at the wording. I'm dealing with a bill now which relates to economic development. And I have not seen the bill, but I've heard about it. And it's talking about the commission, which would be appointed by the governor, would become involved in the operation of the department. And to me, if I were to read that, I've heard it, is that that means that the commission, these are citizens that are appointed to be commissioned, they come down from time to time for meetings, would actually deal with the operation of the department. Now, that's not the job of a commission. It's the job of the director to deal with the operation of it. And my understanding is that that's not what the House intends.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the point. I don't care what the intent. What the law says is what it says. And incidentally, I've had many discussions during my time as a legislator. You know, they say the intent of the bill is, you know, when they speak of it. And I say, well, now have you read it? I don't care what the intent says. This is what the bill says. Oh, that happened many, many times. And so you can't deal with intent. You have to deal with what the words say.
Mm-hmm.
Except in the Constitution, where the courts decide what the words say is not what you think they say. They say something entirely different.
Well, couldn't it be that they say different things to different people, depending on what your interest
is? Yeah,
but
it's still hard to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, wait a minute. I want to read this piece of the Constitution.
Okay.
Now here's what it says. This is section 15A, which is the executive department, Article 5. That's what it says. Single item and emergency clause veto. That's the heading. Then it says, the governor shall have power to veto single items in appropriation bills. First part.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says, and any provision in new bills declaring an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I know that part declaring an emergency is the key clause, because
that's right. If a bill declines an emergency, then it says here, and you see the point is, it said you can line item veto appropriation bills.
Right.
Then it says, and any provision in new bills declare an emergency.
And isn't part of the reason for that because if you declare an emergency on a bill, it immediately goes into effect?
That's right, upon passage.
Right.
That's right. And then it finishes without thereby affecting any other provision of such bill. Well, you know, to me that's pretty clear. But that's not, that the Supreme Court somehow interpreted that differently. And so I have difficulty. Now, I think if I were to read that up to 100 people on the street, they would agree with me. But mm-hmm. I think I mentioned to you a long time ago, Saturday Evening Post had a thing called You Be the Judge. And they had a little deal there, and they'd say, this is what happened, and now what did the judge decide? And you know, I was 100% wrong.
Now, what does that say to you?
Well, but you know, that is so clear. And Bob Oliver said, well, Governor, no, that's not what, but Bob, it says right here. And
but what did he say? What was your counsel?
I forgot what he said, but he could say it could be interpreted differently.
And what? But you do know why? Do you know why he said it wasn't being interpreted differently? If it was so clear.
Well, you know, legal people, they think differently than I do. Anyway, went to the courts, and I do have the opinion here somewhere. I think it's a little convoluted, but they came down on the side of only appropriation bills. So.
Well, people said at the time, I guess Russell Sadler said at the time, that Atiyah's vetoing of many bills, quote, has led to a long list of lobbyists at the governor's door seeking to kill bills they could not kill in the House or Senate. Did that occur or not? Or did you have more, did you experience more people trying to get you to veto bills?
The answer is not to me, no. Now, uh-huh. They may have gotten to my assistance. However, my assistants are more loyal to me than they are to any lobbyist.
Right.
And I'm perceptive enough. I don't need a lobbyist now at this stage of my life. 20 years in the legislature now, 6 years as governor, 6-7 years as governor. You know, I really don't need somebody to tell me about what bills are doing. And then I get these memos, actually, on all bills. And I'm sure they may have, I don't recall it coming to me. Mm-hmm. Maybe one or two, I don't recall that. Mm-hmm. Certainly not long lines. Mm-hmm. But they may have talked to my assistants to deal with this subject. But I still say that the loyalty to was more to me. My assistants, you know, they're not running for election or anything like that. And I said earlier, and I don't disagree, that I think lobbyists are very valuable people. Mm-hmm. Because they can usually give you, you know, you have diverse views, and you get both views, you mm-hmm. know, somewhere, and there is the truth, at least the truth as you can see it. So I don't, lobbyists to me aren't evil people. But, no, there are just some things that match up with my idea what democracy and government's all about, and some don't. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think we talked about it before, but there was the issue of the difficulty of overriding vetoes without calling a special session if you vetoed bills after the session adjourns.
Yeah, but there's not much you can do about that. Mm-hmm. A whole lot of what the legislature does will happen in the last couple right. of weeks. And I had 20 days to deal with bills. And I had this big load. I mean, I'd stay, it would be early in the morning, late at night, and of course the staff is working overtime, and there's not much you can do about it. They've gone home. And so then that holds up the law. Now, vetoing doesn't actually repeal. It doesn't become repealed until the next time the legislature meets. They either don't deal with it, or they don't actually try and override and don't make it. Mm-hmm. Then it's gone. But it lingers. And the Constitution also says that they have to deal with vetoes at the next session. Mm-hmm. And it could be the next regular session. Or if I happen to call for some other reason, we don't call them for vetoes, call a special session, then they have to deal with it at that time. Mm-hmm.
There was another issue here that was interesting. It might have been in this same article, but it said the legislature began seriously invading executive branch prerogatives several years ago when it persuaded voters to amend the state constitution to require Senate confirmation of executive appointments. Games played to win confirmation by the Senate have seriously hindered Atiyah's ability to run the executive branch with people of his choosing.
I agree with that.
And that came up, didn't it, when you were trying to make your early appointments?
That's right. We talked about it, and I said, you know, I finally said to the legislators, now, if my appointee has to meet your muster, which, of course, in this case was Democrat control of both House and Senate, uh-huh. whose appointee is it, mine or yours? And I felt very strongly about it. Mm-hmm. But back to what I said even way back. I was a great defender of the legislative branch of government and a great defender of the executive branch of government. And this violated my thoughts in that respect. If they had said, which was, as a matter of fact, I don't recall it was the case at all, where they were dealing with some of my appointees, this person is not qualified, then I can understand, you know, they say, look, this person is not qualified to do that job. But if they tell me I don't like him or I don't like his philosophy, that's something else again.
Later on, in September of 1985, Marion County Circuit Court Judge Val Sloper ruled that Attia did not have the ability, did not have the constitutional authority to line item veto a bill passed by the 1983 Oregon legislature involving retirement benefits for colleges and university faculty members. If upheld, it would eliminate Attia's line item veto of two bills passed by the 1985 legislature involving the state lottery and industrial revenue bonds. Yeah. Yeah. Was it upheld?
No. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, agreed with Val Sloper, that I can't. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we already talked about the comparable worth bill.
Yeah. Well, back to that again momentarily.
Sure.
I'm sure we fully explored that. First of all, I said, there's no need to have a law because we're doing what you say we ought to be doing. There's no need for a law. Mm-hmm. And that's why I vetoed the bill. We were dealing with it right there.
Which bill was that?
Comparable worth.
The comparable worth. Oh, okay.
And so the whole point was that we were dealing with it. We had it set up. We were working with it. We didn't need them to tell me to do something I'm already doing. Mm-hmm. And they got, if I recall correctly, a little more detail than was necessary in advance of any decision that was going to take place. Mm-hmm. And so there was no need for it.
During this whole period of time, there was a tug of war which developed between you and the legislature over your airplane versus their showers. Did it actually come down to that?
I'm not sure it was a trade-off, but incidentally, they got their showers.
Mm-hmm. And did you get your airplane?
No. Uh-huh. That really was lack of courage. I said, look, I'm going to offer it up. I think it's important. And I do, incidentally, think it's very important. I think we may have covered that. As a matter of fact, I know we did. But the fact is that I was thinking as much in terms of my agency directors as I was in terms of myself. And that I wanted them to what I call circuit ride, get out, go to the different offices we have around the state. And that I thought was good administration, good operation of state government. And it was very difficult for them to do that, particularly in the further reaches of the state. Hardly ever they would go because it would probably be a 3-day deal, one day there to get there, one day to be there, one day to come back. And with an airplane, they could do this all maybe 2 or 3 cities in one day.
So it would save a lot of money in the long run.
Save a lot of money and would, I think, be good management of state government. And the other thing is it was very difficult for a governor to leave to go to the further reaches of the state. You have a lot of what you call lost time if you're, mm-hmm. if you're driving. And with an airplane, a governor could go repeatedly to all over the state, and it's important. Oregonians need to feel that whether we're talking about Burns, Oregon, or Gold Beach, or Elgin, they need to know they're part of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And it's hard for a governor to do this by automobile. What the legislature did is they put money in the budget for me to lease an airplane. Lease is not the right word. To charter an airplane. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to Burns, and then I go to the Salem Airport, and we charter a plane and fly there and fly back. Mm-hmm. And that somewhat hinders it in the sense that you know, you would think, well, gosh, I'm still going to spend money from the budget. At that time, I had something specific in mind. And I had finally arrived after traveling all these years at what kind of an airplane would be the right kind of an airplane for Oregon. And that airplane actually was an airplane of mine, and I had one in mind. It was a Medford Corporation, and it was a King Air, which was a twin engine, and it was all weather, meaning it was pressurized, it had radar, and they were selling their plane. But whale of a buy, I mean, it would have been a lot less than you tried.
Wasn't it $800,000?
Yeah, this would have been half or more than half less than what that plane would have been. But they didn't have the courage, you know, to buy an airplane. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it was rather wasteful. And they never really captured the idea of what the value of that airplane was going to be. So I think I know I did mention, because we talked about it before, somebody sent me a little toy wooden one and says, this is the only airplane you're going to get, which of course is true. But you know, I recall at a national governor's meeting, and the governor of North Dakota was talking to the governor of South Dakota. I happened to be sitting in between. And he said, what kind of a plane do you have? And he was describing his airplane, and my airplane, and I'm sitting, this is North and South Dakota. The state of Washington they have at least three airplanes available to the governor. I'm sure California has probably a fleet. And here we are in Oregon without one of those things.
You would think that the members of the legislature that come from the more isolated areas outside of the Willamette Valley, even the coast, southern Oregon, eastern Oregon, central Oregon, that they would really favor that because they get more attention from
the strange thing is that they didn't. They, you know, they were saying that's no, the governor's wasting money. Uh-huh. And obviously, I only have a couple of years left in my term as a governor.
Right, so it's going to benefit the next.
It's going to be beneficial to the new governor, whoever that might have been.
Yeah.
But still, they didn't do it.
And they still haven't.
And they still haven't.
Hmm. But they did get their showers.
They got their showers. Yes.
You didn't veto that.
No. No, if they want to stand the heat for that, that's okay with me.
Well, you also vetoed House Bill 2001 calling for the Oregon Investment Council gradually to sell off stocks and bonds in companies that fail to follow the expanded Sullivan principles. And I believe that we did talk about this in another section. A set of ethical guidelines aimed at improving conditions in South Africa for South Africa blacks.
Yeah.
And you said, my heart and reason were at terrible odds.
Yeah, well, because I think apartheid's wrong. Mm-hmm. But, I know apartheid's wrong. But the point is, you don't have a bad bill to solve a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the bill was bad because?
Well, it was the kind of bill that says that, remember I talked about,
right.
This is my savings account. And you can't, it's not your money to deal with.
Mm-hmm. You also had a veto of Senate Bill 769, which would have authorized the Secretary of State's office to do performance audits. It has traditionally had the authority to perform. ATIA said performance audits by the Secretary of State would intrude in the governor's powers.
That's right. Not just the governor's power. The governor is the administrator of state government. And if the governor is running government wrong, then the governor should be replaced. It is not up to somebody else to decide if the governor is running government right, meaning another elected official. It's up to the people to make that decision, the voters that put the governor in to run the state of Oregon. That's what the governor is supposed to do. And to get a Secretary of State saying you shouldn't have done it this way, this is subjective. You see, there's no real, there's no precise method of determining are you doing it the right way or the most efficient way. It's a subjective thing. And so, you know, if it was very clear and it said you're going to do this on Monday and that on Tuesday and that on Wednesday and you didn't do it on Tuesday, well, okay, I can understand that, but that's not how it comes down. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of State audits the financial records. Now, that's a very precise thing. You're either spending it right or you're spending it wrong. But performance,